Hi. How you doing? Good to see you. You know, it's good to see Glenn up here leading songs, isn't it? It's good to see Glenn, and I see his sisters back in town, back from Chile, right? You're here just for the day. So, glad to have you back. Be worth talking to her, because I think she was able to spend time with the brethren down there in Chile, and probably has a few stories to tell you about that. So, it's been a while since I've been up here, and it's good to be back up here. Schedules have just been very busy. I've been out of town quite a bit. We will be heading to camp this year as well, so we'll be here the following week, but then the next couple weekends we'll be at Camp Davidson in Oregon. So that'll be good. Looking forward to that a lot. Looking forward to the camp there. It is a good experience. When I was younger too, wasn't in 63 though. I went to camp quite a few times, and it is a life-shaping thing, I think. When you have a good camp experience, it really is a good life-shaping thing. And then I went back and worked at camp later on when I went to college, and that's a whole other dimension to it. So, you know, both sides of that. If you've been to camp before and you liked it, you know, think about sometime going back and contributing to it. It's a good experience that way, too. All right, then. Today I'm going to speak on the work of God as like a rough-cut diamond. Oh, wait. I read the wrong one in the announcement bulletin. Sorry about that. Thanks, Dan, for your sermonette, by the way. Now, actually, what I'm going to speak on this morning is faith in our vision. And it's a pretty lofty topic. And there's some concepts, though, I'd like to help us understand a little bit better today, because faith is termed as one of the weightier matters of the law. So justice, mercy, and faith are defined as three weightier matters of the law. Bigger, not that they're saying more important, but they're just more deeper, bigger, kind of weightier things to think about. In other words, the example was used of, you know, giving tithe on spices and saying, you know, these things you shouldn't leave undone, but really what the intent and the bigger things that you should think about are these type of things. And I want to talk about one of those bigger type of things today. And I'd like to focus it a little bit, because it's a very broad topic and there's a lot of scriptures there, on faith as it relates to our vision. Now, I think we should examine our vision a bit, that we kind of hold on to today. You know, what is your vision like? Is it more a negative, fearful type of vision? You know, is it one that's always dwelling on things that you cannot do? Do you spend all your time on things that, you know, I can't do this or I can't do that? Habakkuk 2:4 says, "The just shall live by faith." There is a way of life, living by faith, that it says the just shall live a certain way. Do we live this way? I think it's easy to kind of just quickly answer, yes, we live this way. But I'd like to kind of show you a couple things and to kind of get into our thinking. You know, do we hold on to the kind of the wrong view of life as a Christian? And is that maybe holding us back a bit? Is that maybe holding us back in what you know, certain things? So what are some of the things I am talking about? What is the problem I'm talking about? Let me just give you a few pieces of evidence. I'm just going to buzz through these very quickly. If you turn over to Matthew 24, verse 9, you know, I think sometimes we latch on to this concept and we say it over and over again to ourselves that he who endures to the end, the same shall be saved. And we use it in the context of, you know, we just have to kind of hang in there. We're just, you know, barely keeping our heads above water. I'm hanging in there. My week in, my week out is just kind of barely getting by. You know, I'm enduring through this entire time here on earth. Well, let's turn to that scripture where that's mentioned and see the context there, because it's interesting. It says in verse 9, Matthew 24, verse 9, says, "They'll deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. You'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved." Now, in that context, you know, are these things happening right now? To a certain degree, we could say, sure, there's false prophets and things like that. But what this is speaking of is a time really more at the end of times where there is great tribulation, great pressure, great time where people are betraying one another over the true religion. And in that context, it says, he who endures through that shall be saved. Now, again, I'm not minimizing enduring in life today, but I think sometimes we latch onto that phrase and say, that's all we do in life right now. this is really saying, there's going to be a time of great tribulation at the end, or time where it gets very intense, that there will be a need for great endurance at that time. So I think that this is talking yet about a future time. Now, let's look at evidence number two. Turn over quickly to Matthew 25, just the next chapter over. Matthew 25, and there's a parable we're all familiar with. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But let's just hone in on one of these examples that are used here. In Matthew 25, verses 24, the person who received one talent. So he received one talent, he came and said, "Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you had not sown and gathering where you had not scattered seed. I was afraid, and I went and I hid the talent in the ground. Look, here you have what is yours." But he answered back to him, he said, "You're a wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I reap where I had not sown and I gather where I had not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. So take it from him and, you know, give it to him who has more." So there's a attitude and mentality that's described here for a reason, and it says that this person was, like he said, "I was fearful, I was afraid of you and everything else that was out there." And what did he do? He entrenched himself, he took what he was given, and he just dug a hole and stayed right where he was. When Christ came back, he said, you know, he used the words wicked and lazy, and those go together, because he's saying, you should have been out doing something with what I gave you. It's not good enough to dig a hole and sit there in fear and not make movement. And you should have taken it and multiplied it. Now, this is something that's very dire. Why is it dire? Because at the end of this parable, it's not like the person who ended up with just the one talent, you know, gets the smallest reward. They don't get any reward. They miss out. So what he's really describing here is a mentality that's saying that I am in a fearful state, I'm dug in, and I'm not making forward movement or progress on things. That's a piece of evidence number two. Piece of evidence number three is found in Hebrews 11:6. Hebrews 11:6, and I'll just quote this so you don't have to turn to it right now. Hebrews 11:6 just says, "But without faith, it is impossible to please him. So it is not possible for you, without a certain type of mentality in life right now, to please God." The guy with the one talent did not have that. He had the opposite of that mentality. It is an impossibility for you, unless you have this certain type of mindset, for you to be pleasing in the sight of God. Now, that's not an optional thing. It's God's good pleasure to give you his kingdom, and there's a lot of things that he wants to give you, but he wants to see this in our lives. He wants to see this developed in our lives. And if you turn to Hebrews 10:38, piece of evidence number four, Hebrews 10:38, it says, "The just shall live by faith here." Now, the just shall live by faith, but it says, "But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him again." So it's contrasting the same thing that was said and demonstrated in these other verses, is saying that you have to live by faith or with this mentality, with those who draw back, God's very soul, his being, his emotions and things don't take pleasure in a person who draws back. It's the same thought carried forward in another verse. Yes, that means draws back to sinning and to other things, but I think it also means it in every sense of the word, where we end up recoiling, where we end up digging in like the person with one talent, we end up in a fearful state, and we end up not moving forward or making progress. Last piece of evidence, number five, is the concept of trials. And we've had a lot of great sermons and topics on this, but how do we view this life? Is it one where we just sit and suffer? Is it just about pain and suffering that's here? You know, when these things happen, is it the end of the world? Is it something that we languish in? And is it, and like I said in the beginning, is it something where we're just barely making it through life? I'm just trying to keep my head above water. Now, there's going to be periods in trials where things are more intense than other times. But what I'm talking about is a general outlook towards them that you have in your life, that when trials and things come, what is the proper context or way to view these type of things? Is it just all we're meant to do here is to sit and have pain and suffering for, you know, sometimes a reason or reasons we can't figure out? Now, there's other things that we could talk about here, but I just wanted to put forth just a few different kind of ideas and throw them on the table and say that, you know, when you start to kind of package all these things up, and if you dwell on that and that is your kind of mode of operating out of fear and that it's just a life of suffering and that's it, and, you know, that we draw back or that we don't make forward progress, then what we end up having is we end up having these components of a negative vision, one that you're kind of in a defensive state. And what I'd like to show you today is about faith. I'd like to help us to understand that faith is the opposite of that. Faith is really, you know, works a vision inside of you that results in positive forward movement despite calamity, despite all of these things. And that God says, this is what I take pleasure in, is this type of mentality. Now, is that something that we have to work up or get our emotions going? I like to show you, and what I like to really break down is to show you the components of faith, because it's spelled out for us in the Bible in a lot of different ways, the things to really dwell on that make up faith here. So let's really understand faith. Now, if we want to understand faith, where do we turn to in the Bible? I think I heard Hebrews. That's right. We turn to Hebrews. Let's turn over to Hebrews 11. Now, faith is defined there, Hebrews 11. Let's turn over and see this. But let's understand this a bit better. Let's have a little bit of a Bible study on this part, because sometimes we just stop, you know, faith is this. But faith is a weightier matter of the law and a concept that needs some explaining to help you get the intent, to help you to understand exactly what it's talking about. You can't just say one sentence. And you know what? Hebrews doesn't just do that. Hebrews not only defines it with kind of what it is, it also then breaks out, here's some of the components that are inside of outlook of faith. And then if that's not enough, let me show you by example what it looks like played out in people's lives. So if you want to get a complete definition of what faith is, you have to go through the whole book of Hebrews, and you have to pull out the pieces of it to really understand what it is. And so let's see that. Let's pull out not only the definition, but let's look at the components, and then let's look at it demonstrated by an example. First it says in Hebrews 11, verse 1, it says, now faith is the substance, and substance means, you know, the realization, the solid ground, you know, the thing that is tangible to you of things hoped for, the evidence. So it's a confidence, it's a reality, it's a proof of what? It's of things not seen. So it's a very much a solid substance. It's a reality or a proof of things that you can't physically see with your very own eyes, basically. And so when you look at that faith, if you have faith, it is a tangible thing that you hold on to because you see things that are not seen. It doesn't quite make sense, but I think you understand what I'm saying. You see things that are not on a physical level before your eyes, and you have proof and belief in that. It's in a tangible way, and that tangible way is something that's called faith. And that faith then is demonstrated a certain way. And it goes on to say, you know, in verse 2, for by it the elders obtained a good testimony. And it also says, by faith we understand that the worlds, and the word worlds there is aeon, which, you know, really means, it can mean universe, but it also encompasses the concept of the ages of man, civilizations, you know, the Romans, the Egyptians, our modern-day society today. There's definitely different ages, you know, the medieval time period. These things are all ages of man that you see down through time. This says that we understand that those ages were framed by the Word of God so that the things which are seen are not made of things which are visible. And by faith we understand, again, that those civilization and those things were determined up front and shaped and framed. In other words, framed, you know, means fit together. You take a frame and frame a picture, you fit it together a certain way. Those civilizations and things were put together for a reason by God, is what it's saying. That it was orchestrated for a reason. That's what that's saying here. In faith, by faith we understand that. By faith we understand these things. Now, that start of that definition is, okay, it's kind of hard to grab onto some ways. So Hebrews goes on to then break down what are some different components of this. Let me explain this more is what he's saying. Let me kind of break it down a little bit more. So let's continue on down. In Hebrews 11, verse 6, and this is the verse that we read at the beginning, it says, but without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now, the language here is said for intently for a reason, and there's two components to this. A lot of times people think that faith just stops at, I have faith that there is a God. There's a God out there. And that's not enough, because this is not what it's saying here. That is one half of it. It's saying he who comes to God must believe that he is. That's that part. You believe that there is a God. Now, it doesn't only mean that. It also means that faith is also always towards somebody. You're not just having kind of a general faith. I don't just have a faith in things or, you know, karma or things like that. What you have faith in is a being called God. It is towards a person. You don't just have generic faith. Your faith is in somebody and what they do. That is God. And when you have that faith, which is towards God, that's an important point to understand. It's not just generic. It's towards a being, and that being is God. And when you have that faith, you understand a few things. You understand the second part of this is that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. That sentence describes something. It describes action. It describes movement. It's not enough just to sit there. It describes movement, doesn't it? So when Hebrews goes on to explain it, it's not only in that person, but it results in you understanding that you must diligently seek him and that he's a rewarder of that. Now, you all know James, right? What does James 2:14 say? If you just hold your place there in Hebrews, we'll come back to that. Let's go to James 2:14. And the idea is expressed here and fleshed out by James. Same concept, just fleshed out. James 2 and verse 14. It says, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works, does not have action, does not do something about it? Can the faith save him? It says, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to him, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Some will say, I have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by your works. And it goes on to explain, even the demons believe there's a God. They've got the first half right. The demons believe there's a God. But it does not result in the right action. It does not result in the believing that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Those two components must go together. They cannot be separated. So therefore, your faith, and this is an important concept to understand, becomes and starts to become more strengthened the more you start to act on it as well. But there, those two components, towards God, a being, as well as results in doing something or acting out on that. So let's go back to Hebrews and continue on. So that's one of the components of faith, and that's described there in Hebrews. Again, the first verse just kind of gives you an overview. And then it starts to break out. What are some of the things or components of faith? Hebrews 11, back in verse 8, continues on. Now, another component of faith is listed here. And we don't gloss over this because this is a key here. Hebrews 11, 8 says, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has its foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, it sounds simple, and it sounds, we read that a lot of times, but the people, and we'll notice this again, the people in the book of faith had their sights fixed on something, and that's how they acted. They had their sights fixed on something, and here it says, he waited for a city whose foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, the first part said, look, the ages, the civilization of man have been defined and framed by God. Faith here says we realize there is another civilization and phase and era of man coming. And then this says that you are fixed on that civilization, that you see that as more of a reality than where you are now. That your view is that there is another age to come and that you firmly see that age completely as if it was a reality. And when we read through some of these examples, you'll see that mentioned time and time again. And what I want to put out to you is, if that is the case, how much is that fixed in our minds, really, truly? on a day-to-day basis. And I'll come back to that thought in a little bit. So let's continue on in verse 13. It says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, again, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind the country from which they had come out of, they would have opportunity to return back to that. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. This adds to the thought. Not only do they understand that there's another age to come, it's a greater reality, but what does that say? That they have actually been called out of this age and have been placed prematurely in that age. What do I mean by that? Is the millennium actually come here to earth? No. But you are now a citizen and a member of that kingdom today. You have been taken out of this. That's what it says here. They pulled out of this country and have been placed in an entirely new country, a new ruler, a new kingdom, a new governmental structure, a new authority. The only thing left to fulfill that is for this age to end in the physical manifestation and Christ coming back to this earth to be instituted on the rest of the earth. But the reality that they see is that they are now a part of that today, right now, right? And this is a huge component of faith described here. And it's one that makes up the forward-looking aspect of it. Because faith is not just a matter of, okay, I wake up today and my back is hurting and I haven't had my coffee and my brain is foggy and, you know, I've got a lot of things going on this week and I just can't quite, you know, make it. What this is talking about is putting your sights and your vision so far forward and looking at that, that it pulls you towards that, right? And it says here, truly if they called to mind the country what they came out of, they'd have opportunity to return. They fully abandoned what this has to offer here. Now, I'm not saying you sell your house and go eat locusts in the desert, but mentally, have you fully abandoned that? Because it says if you start to call to mind the country which you came out of and start to look at it, it will look appealing to you. Trust me on that. It will start to look appealing to you. This world has a lot of things to offer. This world will offer you things that appeal to you. It will do that. You know, I work at a huge company, and I've seen quite a few appeals and pulls that play on people, including money and power and other kinds of vices. And you see these things pull on people, and it has a tremendous sway. And what this is saying is if you call to mind and you start to dwell on those things, you know what? You're going to have an opportunity and give yourself an opportunity to go back into that. Because they've taken their mind off of the vision, the forward-looking place that they should be going to. Now, this is not, and I want to get a little bit more specific and concrete on this topic as we go to make it very, very real. But this is an important concept here, and I guess it's starting to just come to me not to underestimate this, because when you start to just deal on a day-to-day basis with your day-to-day struggle, it's the concept that you'll have an opportunity to return. You'll get bogged down in that. But if you lift your eyes up and see something further out, further on, then those things become easier to deal with. Your problems become easier to deal with. You make forward progress on things. And we'll come back to that thought because it's important. And all the people in here had this in their description. It's not by coincidence that it keeps mentioning this. It's a very powerful concept. So if we don't see past just where we are, what we're in, what we're going through, and what's around us, then we'll get sucked right back into that. And that's interesting. Hold your place here, but go back to Matthew 8. And that's why that this parable that Christ mentions is here. Christ said of somebody that he's never seen such great faith in all of the world. Who was that? And why did he say that? There's a reason he said that, and it's the same concept that we're just describing and talking about here. Matthew 8, verse 5, the story of the centurion. I don't know if you remember this one, but it says, Matthew 8, 5, now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant's lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. And the centurion's answer is very interesting. He says, look, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, and I have soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and another, come, and he comes, and to my servant I say, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those followed, surely I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. Why did he say that of this person? Because what is he describing there in those verses 8 through 9? What's he describing there? He's describing a vision of a reality of the kingdom that he can see. Remember what we're talking about in Hebrews? There's this vision of a kingdom. When he says, look, I am also a man under authority. He said that to Christ saying, I understand the authority that you hold and what authority you're under. I also am a man like you under authority. I can say, go do this and this and this just with my word, and people do it. His vision was clearly he understood who Christ was, what his kingdom was, and that was so real to him, he could say, I understand the authority that you have, and you can just say the word, and it was so real to him. That is why he said you have such great faith, is because he saw the reality of that kingdom and Christ under that here today. And, you know, he was in the kind of the same position, so, you know, he maybe had some insight into that, you know, what that means. That's exactly why he said he has not found such great faith, because this man could see the kingdom as clear as day today. You know, is the kingdom that clear to us? You know, sometimes we say, what's our goal to make it to the kingdom? But that's not what I'm talking about. Is it very clear how real it is in your life now? Do you see it operating on a day-to-day basis? Do you take the time to say to God that I am part of your kingdom, I am not of this world, I need the power and the authority of the kingdom to heal in my life, to do something to help? Do you see yourself on a day-to-day basis operating in that reality? And that is the reality. Because if you're just looking at this world and the trials and things that happen in it, those will tend to overwhelm you. And this is saying you recognize the reality of the kingdom and you're a part of it. You see it. You see it right now. Let's go back to Hebrews 11 and continue on with this. Hebrews 11, there's another attribute of faith that's described here. And there's a very interesting scripture here, Hebrews 11, 24, 26, or through 27, actually. Hebrews 11, one of my favorite sets of scriptures. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. He esteemed the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasure in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. For he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Now, are some of the things that we've been talking about coming back to you in these scriptures here? Okay, what are some of the things that we see here? Another result or attribute of this faith is that we come out of sin with it. And we want to come out of sin. But you see why? Why? At the end of verse 26, he says, because he looked to the reward. He looked to that kingdom and the ultimate reward that was there. Now, what's very interesting about the scenario is we kind of, you know, read over it. Moses had to choose between two things, suffer the affliction with the people of God or enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And I think it means what it says there. I think that he was in and operating in a certain environment that, you know, was enjoying here, maybe up and down, the things that were around him, passing pleasures of sin. He may have been operating on a certain level based on, you know, the Egyptians at the time. The different sins and the things. And you can see this kind of acted out. You remember when someone struck down the Israelite, when the Egyptians, you know, was beating an Israelite, what did he do? He understood who he was, that he was going to save Israel, but what did he do? He went and he acted out in a wrong way. He killed the Egyptian with his own hands. Right? There's a certain, you can kind of see him that he is a man of God and he has faith in God, but he's so entrenched and stuck in this Egyptian place that he kind of came to the realization at that point in time that, okay, this is not right. I'm going down the wrong path. And he forsook. He said, this is the wrong thing. The passing pleasures of sin, the things that this all has to offer, I'm kind of in and out of it. I need to go. I remove myself from this. I leave. I flee. And then God, what happened for the next 40 years is he trained and he tuned that person named Moses tested that faith and tried him over and over again in the wilderness, to where he ended up at a place physically he may not have been as impressive as he was to start with, being in Egypt, and you know, maybe he was eloquent and learned and everything by that time. By the end, he was probably in rags in the desert, and he stuttered right through the end of the process. But not until he got to that point in that time were works of faith done. Right there, it wasn't until he got to that point in his life that he was able to be used by God and come back and then produce and do great exploits through the power of God. It had to come to that point. It had to come to that. And again, you see the elements that are here. He saw the invisible God. He had his vision fixed forward. And then he came out of the sin rather than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin that were there. So again, it's a forward-looking thing. It's not a feeling. It's forward-looking. It results in faith, and it results in movement. And you can see this played out. One of the things that happens when you live a life of faith and that you're at the point where you've been trained by it like Moses was, then there are great exploits that happen. You don't get to skip that stage, though. You don't get to skip through that training as Moses spent 40 years in the wilderness and get to the end to do that work. What it says here, like in verse 30, it says, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down. You know, and then it talks about Rahab. And then it says in verse 32, what more shall I say to tell, you know, time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and also David and Samuel the prophets who through faith did what? Some amazing things. Subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, people received their dead raised to life again. On and on and on it goes. Now notice this doesn't say this person stayed holed up in their house for 30 years and didn't let anything encroach on them. I say that kind of facetiously to point out that when you get to the place of faith, these people were moving forward and doing great things in the power of God, great exploits. A lot of these may look just physical to you, fighting in a battle, things like that. But it says it was through faith they did these things. They became valiant in battle, turned to flight armies. They did some amazing things in this lifetime through faith. So what we see then is the result, the end result. You see the process described above, faith in a God, resulting in action, resulting in coming out of sin, being tested and tried during a period of time, and then great exploits are done at the end. So there's a pattern that's described here for us. The whole book of Hebrews helps us understand that. Don't just take the one sentence out of context or one component. Put the different components of faith together and as demonstrated here, and that's how you get to the point where those great exploits are carried out. Now, I mentioned at the beginning about vision, and this type of faith is an important component of vision because it's more powerful for you to be pulled towards something than you to be repelled from things. It's kind of, in some ways, a hard concept to understand, but you know, if you spend your whole life saying, oh, I have to just kind of stay away from this, and I have to stay away from that, and I have to stay away from that, your whole life is spent in kind of just a defensive position. What faith is putting out to us is that there is a power in seeing things afar off so that you're pulled towards them, if that makes more sense. Now, I didn't say we don't put away sin. I'm just saying, like, if you think of where your mind is and your focus and your vision, if you're focusing and having yourself pulled towards something compelling, that is way more powerful. Anybody who has kids knows this, right? If you tell your kids, don't do this all day long, they walk around moping, and yeah, they shouldn't do those things, but give them something exciting to do. And Courtney got to go to, you know, Water World or this week, and it was the time of her life, just having the greatest time. You know, being pulled towards something that is very exciting is a very powerful thing, right? Am I just making that up? What does Hebrews 12:2 say? Hebrews 12:2. Here's our ultimate example of this. This is looking to who? Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. For who? For what? Why did he endure the cross? Was he running from these people out of fear? It says, for the joy that was set before him. Where was Christ's mind through the most excruciating time of his life? Was forward looking. He had firmly fixed in his mind the joy that was before him. He wasn't in a defensive, fighting off position. He had his mind forward looking way past this and saw the joy so clearly that he went through this. It's easy to read over that, but you know what? That is a huge key. And that's why I say we have to understand the reality of this kingdom and start to put our minds more on that than just being in a defensive, fearful position. I'm not just saying that to kind of throw out another nice saying. This is the power of faith. This is how you see and how you get there. And think of this kind of as two ways. You know, if you're always in a fearful, defensive place and you dwell on that, that's what's going to reign in your life. If you're looking at a positive, forward-moving, looking vision, you're going to start to move that way. Just to give you a little story, a tiny story, there was an elder Cherokee Native American was teaching his grandchildren about life. He said to them, a fight is going on inside me. It's a terrible fight, and it's between two wolves. One wolf represents fear, anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, ego, and unfaithfulness. The other wolf stands for joy, peace, love, hope, sharing, serenity, humility, kindness, forgiveness, benevolence, friendship, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faithfulness. The same fight is going on inside of you. He's talking to his kids and every other person too. And then they thought about that for a minute, and then one of the children asked the grandfather, well, which wolf will win? And the old Cherokee replied simply, the one you feed. And it's the same concept. Faith is feeding the forward-looking vision all the time. That's what it's feeding. The one you feed is the one that wins in your life. It's not a matter of drumming it up. It's the one you feed and dwell and concentrate on. Now, when you go through this period of faith, you can count on that faith being tested and tried. And this is where the concept of trials comes in too. Let's turn to James 1, verse 2. And there's a set of scriptures we've read a lot of times. James 1, verse 2 here. It says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and lacking in nothing. And so there is a process that's going to happen here. It says, knowing that the testing of that faith produces patience in you. Now, when God gives us these circumstances and trials, it is to test. When we say test, it's to test the metal of the faith and strengthen it. God's goal is not to destroy you. There's somebody who wants to destroy you, but that's not God. God's goal is to want to strengthen you. So when you start to exhibit that faith, God says, okay, that's a good start. Let's take that and let's make that so strong that it doesn't break. And that process, like it or not, is what we go through when we go through these trials, like it says here, when you fall into various trials. That is what is happening. God is not doubting you. He's strengthening you. You know what? You might not get it right the first time or the second or the fourth. But you will start to grow and to get that right. And you know what? There's a few examples in the Bible. I'll just mention some of them to you that you can think about. Moses is one of those. What about Abraham? Abraham himself, who's called the father of the faithful, what about when God promised, you know, a child to him? What happened there? There was a bit of a misstep, wasn't there? He kind of said, oh, well, you know, I'm getting past, we're all past our age, prime of life, we can't have kids. And, you know, I don't know if he had a little bit of a doubt, and then he stuck in his own human reasoning in there, and he used his handmaid. God says, nope, that's not it. What did God do after that? He made him wait a long, long time, number of years after that. Why? Is this punishment? God was helping him to test and to make sure that that faith, he wavered at first, became rock solid. That's what was happening there. This is not a, you know, we don't like you, Abraham, this was a, okay, you had a few missteps and you kind of went off on faith the wrong way. By the end, it was so rock solid that he knew that God could provide a son, even after he's well over 100 or later on in years, and that even if he asked him to kill his son, that he could resurrect him. That's how rock solid it was by that time. Only then does he get the name, Father of the Faithful, by that time. But you see, what happened was that it was tested and strengthened and tried. Same thing happened with David and Saul. David was anointed king. That's like somebody coming up to you and saying, okay, I now put you in charge of church, in the church. Okay? I now anoint you to be head of the whole church. And then what you find is maybe corruption happening in the church, and that you would have to wait as God delivers that through you for, in David's case, 12 years. Same thing happened to him. He was anointed king. He knew he was going to be king, but he could not take matters into his own hands. So for, 12 or so years, he ran in the wilderness as that was tested and tried. God was saying, are you going to trust me in this? Are you going to doubt? Are you going to result to your own reasoning? And he had opportunity to do so, didn't he? What did God put in front of him? Saul, just sitting there, he went to the bathroom in a cave and David was hiding. He had a chance to kill him twice. He could have taken it into his own hands. But God, again, tested that for 12 years. Till then, he gave it. Could you wait that long? Do you see yourself in that process or not? Because if you don't, you're going to lose the vision of what you're going through. You're going to lose that vision. So these people were tested, and the key is that after they were finished, and only after they were finished, were they able to do their great exploits. Moses, helping deliver Israel. David, reigned as king. All of these people. Joseph was another one. Same type of thing. Now, there's something that gets in the way. There's something that gets away in the way of this faith. Your vision. There's something that fogs it over. And this is something that I call the fog of faith. The fog of faith. Now, you won't find the phrase fog of faith in the Bible, so don't start looking in the concordance. But what I mean by that is that Christ says there are basically four things that can fog up your vision. And I'll just have to quote these to you, but there's four phrases. He says, you of little faith, four times. And in those four instances, he lists another reason why they have little faith. He says, oh, you of little faith. The first one is found in Matthew 8:26. I won't turn there if you just write that down. The first one is fear. It says, why are you fearful, O of little faith? The second one is called doubt, and that's in Matthew 14:31. It says, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? And you can go back and see the context of what he says he's in. And then he says another one, Matthew 31, says, it says, now if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? He says, therefore, do not worry. And the third one is really called anxious care or anxiety. Okay, is the third one. And then the last one, where he says, oh, you have little faith, he says, why do you reason among yourselves? And that is in Matthew 16:8. So what we find, there's a fog of faith. There are things that will come upon you and that will cloud that vision of being able to see the kingdom, the reality of it in your life. And it's those four things. Fear, what was that guy at the one talent? Fearful. Doubt, anxiety, and human reasoning. That is the fog of faith. Think about that. The next time you're struggling, see if not one of those things are present with you. See if not one of those things are maybe overwhelming your emotions. Is it anxiety? Or you just can't figure it out? Or have you thought, maybe it would be best if I ended it this way and you took matters into your own hand like Abraham did? That's human reasoning. Abraham had doubt, human reasoning. He did it his own way to start with. There was a fog. He couldn't see it clearly. By the end, that fog was lifted. So this fog of faith can come upon us. And it's not that that is the problem, because these are natural human tendencies. The problem is, does that result in sin? If the fog of faith clouds your view and you're not able to work through it and it results in sin, then we have a problem. Think about ancient Israel. It's exactly what happened to them. They came up against the Red Sea and they were fearful. And then they doubted. And then they, you know, and that is the pattern that they couldn't get over time and time again, which resulted in sin for them. They sinned and kept on sinning because the fog of faith was just so thick over their eyes that they couldn't see anything. You know, same with David. David is a good example of faith. He could have used human reasoning and taken Saul's life, but he chose not to do that. And Abraham learned that as he went along as well. So that is something that we have to look at, the fog of faith and how that affects our eyes. Now, once that starts, you know, we may say, okay, I can see that reality. There's the kingdom. I know I want to have this faith. I know the process that's involved to strengthen my faith. And you know what? That fog of faith, it comes upon me every once in a while. It starts to cloud my vision. I start to get overwhelmed by that fog. I can't see clearly. Like you can't see San Francisco sometimes because it's covered in fog. It's the same type of thing. You can't see the city of God clearly because it's fogged over with the same type of fog. I can see that comes upon me. But exactly how do I move forward? Ancient Israel had this cloud and this fire thing that they could follow. But me? It's not clear to me. I can't see the way. I don't know what to do with my job. I don't know what to do with my marriage. We've had the same argument for 20 years. I don't know how to make progress on that. I don't know what to do with my children. Society is increasingly a certain way, and I don't know how to, you know, raise children a certain way. Should I take this job? Should I not? I don't know how. I can't see clearly. And then we fall back into the fog of faith there. Well, let's turn and see. There's a link here. James 1, verse 2. We'll finish out the scripture that we were reading before. James 1 and verse 2 talks about these trials, but it says something. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work. You may be perfect, complete, lacking nothing. You have to be willing to, you know, complete and lacking. And then it says verse 5 is the key verse. It says, if any of you lacks wisdom, ask God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith and not doubting. No, why? That is linked together with faith. And you know what wisdom is? The wisdom is, how do I do this? If you don't know how to do something, wisdom is the answer to how do you do this? How do I take that next step? I don't know which direction to go in. Would that apply to the church today? What should we be saying? Who should we be approaching? You know what? The answer is found in something that God says is called wisdom. How do you get that answer is that you ask God for wisdom for it. Sounds super simple, but let me ask you this. Are you asking for wisdom on everything you do every single day? If you're not, you're not doing this. This is such a big key to help you to move in the right direction, and it is such a reality. I found in my life when I do not know what to do about any given situation, and guess what? That is every day all the time. I ask God, give me wisdom regarding this situation. I don't want to have the same argument. I don't want to go this direction at work. I don't know what to do. Grant me wisdom on this topic. You know what? Sometimes that comes at once. Sometimes it gets pieced together. But I've never, ever not received something about how to do it, including giving sermons. It's the same thing. God provides that. How do I do that? And that's what it's saying. When we can't see and we don't know what step to take, ask God, give me wisdom on this. I ask and I pray every single day. There's not a magic formula here. There's not something I'm given, you're not given. God just says, if you lack it, I lack it, ask. He'll give it. It's simple. It's very, very simple. That is the how you step in faith. That is how you make forward progress and break through that. the more you understand that and do that, the more that fog of faith just kind of clears up, right? When you ask God and you're having anxiety and say, look, God, you know, I'm worried about this. I need to understand, how do I move forward in this? And the answer comes. The answer comes the first time and the second time and the third time, and you start moving on it. Pretty soon, the next time you get around to it, all those, you know, anxieties and those other things start to kind of dissipate. That fog starts to clear. And as you grow up in faith, it becomes less and less of an occurrence. And you have more and more forward movement. You have more and more stepping. You have know the right direction. Because your confidence is not in your own ability, your own reasoning. You have just asked the God who you believe exists to help you find the way. That is what you have confidence in. That is what you have the faith in. And again, as part of overcoming, if you start to spend more of your thought cycles on this faith and moving towards something, you'll start to see less and less of your problems. Sometimes we work on facing just the problem. I'm not saying not do that. But if you spend your whole life stuck in this kind of mire, going round and round and round, and you're doing the same thing, you can't figure it out, don't know why you're doing this, blah, blah, blah. Lift your eyes up and start moving toward something. And you'll be very surprised how easy it is to let those things go. That's what Hebrews says. Since we see so great a cloud of witness, let's lay aside the sin that easily besets us. Okay? The same type of thing that happens there. So, to finish this up, I ask you the questions again. You know, is our mentality one where we're just hanging on, barely hanging on? And I don't mean to minimize that if you're struggling, because we struggle. But I'm talking about a mentality in life. You view the Christian life as just sitting and suffering, and I just got to hang on. Or in the face of this adversity, because you recognize what's happening, are you able to ask God, say, I need to make a step. I want to make a step, and I want to make a forward movement. Are you moving forward? Or have you entrenched? Have you holed up? Have you just taken what you have and just kind of hanging on to it till the end? That person doesn't get there. It's very clear. God takes delight in this other mentality. That's why I put the two next to each other. God delights in that one mentality. He doesn't ask you to figure it out. He just delights in that you rely on God and that you're asking Him and through His power making those steps. And I firmly believe that it's not until then is when we get to do great exploits. I think there's a view that, you know, we hang on to the end, the kingdom comes, but I think when you read your Bible, you'll see that there's going to be some great things that are done, you know, at the end time by His people. But it's not going to be everybody. It's only going to be those who have learned to walk in faith now. Right? It's only those who have learned to walk in faith now. It's that important. I think there will be a time where you, not the people standing up on the stage, but God will work through you and say, I need to do a witness or a miracle or something. And those who live by faith and have learned this pattern their whole life will be able to do things they never thought were going to happen to them. That's my firm belief. And Daniel 11:32 bears this out. Final scripture, Daniel 11:32. Daniel 11:32 says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and shall carry out great exploits. Hebrews 11 teaches us that pattern. Therefore, I propose to you today, let's just not be fearful, hanging on, defensive, but let's pick up our eyes and look to the kingdom and the reality of that and start to make forward progress towards a vision.